the first time he set eyes on him. I'll find him, David. That's what I came all this way for. And I'm gonna find him. Either I'll find him or he'll find me. I told you. I made him a promise, and I'm gonna keep it. You're round a ratty twist, Bertie, said his friend, opening a stable door and coming over to examine my leg. Round a ratty twist, that's all I can say. He picked up my hoof and lifted it gently. This one's got a white sock on his front legs anyway. That's as far as I can tell under all this blood and mud. I'll just sponge the wound away a bit, clean it up for you whilst I'm here. You'll never get this one cleaned up in time else, and I've finished mucking out my ruddy stables. Not a lot else to do, and it looks as if you could do with an end. Old Sergeant Thunder won't mind, not if I've done all he told me, and I have.
The two men worked tirelessly on me, scraping and brushing and washing. I stood quite still, trying only to nuzzle Albert to make him turn and look at me. But he was busying at my tail and my hindquarters now.
Three, said his friend, washing off another of my hooves. That's three white socks.
Turn it up, David, said Albert. I know what you think. I know everyone thinks I'll never find him. There's thousands of army horses with four white socks, I know that. But there's only one with a blaze in the shape of a cross on his forehead. And how many horses shine red like fire in the evening sun, I tell you. There's not another one like him, not in the old wide world.
Four, said David. That's four legs and four white socks. Only the cross on the forehead now, and a splash of red paint on this muddy mess of horse, and you'll have your Joey standing here.
Don't tease, said Albert quietly. Don't tease, David. You know how serious I am about Joey. It'll mean all the world to me to find him again. My only friend I ever had before I came to the war, I told you. I grew up with him, I did. My only creature on this earth I ever felt any kinship for.
David was standing now by my head. He lifted my mane and brushed gently at first, then vigorously at my forehead, blowing the dust away from my eyes. He peered closely and then set to again brushing down towards the end of my nose and up again between my ears till I tossed my head with impatience.
Bertie, he said quietly. I'm not teasing, honest, I'm not, not now. You said your Joey had four white socks even to the last inch, right?
Right, said Albert, still brushing away at my tail.
And you said your Joey had a white cross on his forehead.
Right. Albert was still completely disinterested.
Now, I have never seen a horse like that, Bertie, said David, using his hand to smooth down the hair on my forehead. Wouldn't have thought it possible.
Well, it is, I tell you, said Albert sharply. And he was red, flaming red in the sunlight, like I said.
I wouldn't have thought it possible, his friend went on, keeping his voice in check. Not until now, that is.
Oh, pack it in, David, Albert said, and there was genuine irritation in his voice now. I've told you, haven't I? I told you I'm serious about Joey.
So am I, Bertie. Dead serious, no messing. I'm serious. This horse has four white socks, all evenly marked, like you said. This horse has a clear white cross on his head. This horse, as you can see for yourself, has a black mane and tail. This horse stands over 16 hands, and when he's cleaned up, he'll look pretty as a picture. And this horse is a red bay under all that mud, just like you said, Bertie.
As David was speaking, Albert suddenly dropped my tail and moved slowly around me, running his hand along my back. Then, at last, we stood facing one another. There was a rougher hue to his face, I thought. He had more lines around his eyes, and he was a broader, bigger man in his uniform than I remembered him. But he was my Albert. And there was no doubt about it. He was my Albert.
Joey, he said tentatively, looking into my eyes. Joey?
I tossed up my head and called out to him in my happiness, so that the sound echoed around the yard and brought horses and men to the door of their stables.
It could be, said Albert quietly. You're right, David. It could be him. It sounds like him, even. But there's one way I know to be sure.
And he untied my rope and pulled a halter off my head. Then he turned and walked away to the gateway before facing me, cupping his hands to his lips and whistling. It was his owl whistle, the same low, stuttering whistle he had used to call me when we were walking out together back at home on the farm all those long years before. Suddenly there was no longer any pain in my leg, and I trotted easily over towards him and buried my nose in his shoulder. "It's him, David," Albert said, putting his arms around my neck and hanging on to my mane. "It's my Joey. I found him. He's come back to me just like I said he would."
"See?" said David wryly.
"What did I tell you? See, not often wrong, am I?"
"Not often," Albert said. "Not often. And not this time."
Chapter 18. In the euphoric days that followed our reunion, the nightmare I had lived through seemed to fade into unreality. The war itself was suddenly a million miles away and of no consequence. At last, there were no guns to be heard, and the only vivid reminder that suffering and conflict was still going on were the regular arrivals of veterinary wagons from the front. Major Martin cleaned my wound and stitched it up, and though at first I could still put little weight on it, I felt in myself stronger with every day that passed. Albert was with me again, and that in itself was medicine enough. But properly fed once more with warm mash each morning and a never-ending supply of sweet-scented hay, my recovery seemed only a matter of time. Albert, like the other veterinary orderlies, had many other horses to care for, but he would spend every spare minute he could find fussing over me in the stable. To the other soldiers, I was something of a celebrity, so I was scarcely ever left alone in my stable. There always seemed to be one or two faces looking admiringly over my door. Even Old Thunder, as they called the sergeant, would inspect me over, zealously, and when the others were not about, he would fondle my ears and tickle me under my throat, saying,
"Quite a boy, aren't you? Thundering fine horse, if ever I saw one. You get better now, do you hear?"
But time passed, and I did not get better. One morning I found myself quite unable to finish my mash, and every sharp sound, like the kick of a bucket or the rattle of a bolt on the stable door, seemed to set me on edge and made me suddenly tense from head to tail. My forelegs in particular would not work as they should. They were stiff and tired, and I felt a great weight of pain all along my spine, creeping into my neck and even my face. Albert noticed something was wrong when he saw the mash I had left in my bucket.
"What's the matter with you, Joey?"
he said anxiously, and he reached out his hand to stroke me in the way he often did when he was concerned. Even the sight of his hand coming towards me, normally a welcome sign of affection, struck an alarm in me, and I backed away from him into the corner of the stable. As I did so, I found that the stiffness in my front legs would hardly allow me to move. I stumbled backwards, falling against the brick wall at the back of the stable and leaning there heavily.
"I thought something was wrong yesterday,"
said Albert, standing still now in the middle of the stable.
"Thought you were a bit off collar then. Your back's as stiff as a board and you're covered in sweat. What the devil have you been up to, you old silly?"
He moved slowly now towards me, and although his touch still sent an irrational tremor of fear through me, I stood my ground and allowed him to stroke me.
"Perhaps it was something you picked up on your travels. Perhaps you ate something poisonous, is that it? But then that would have shown itself before now, surely."
"You'll be fine, Joey, but I'll go and fetch Major Martin just in case. He'll look you over, and if there's anything wrong, put you right quick as a twick, as my father used to say. Wonder what he would think now if he could see us together. He never believed I'd find you either. Said I was a fool to go. Said it was a fool's errand, and I'd likely get myself killed in the process, but he was a different man, Joey. After you left, he knew he'd done wrong. That seemed to take all the nastiness out of him. Seemed to live only to make up for what he'd done. Stopped his Tuesday drinking sessions, looked after Mother as he used to when I was little, and he even began to treat me right, didn't treat me like a workhorse no more." I knew from the soft tone of his voice that he was trying to calm me, as he had done all those long years ago when I was a wild, frightened colt. Then his words had soothed me, but now I could not stop myself from trembling. Every nerve in my body seemed to be taut, and I was breathing heavily. Every fibre of me was consumed by a totally inexplicable sense of fear and dread. "I'll be back in a minute, Joey," he said. "Don't you worry, you'll be all right. Major Martin will fix you. He's a miracle with horses, is that man." And he backed away from me and went out. It was not long before he was back again with his friend, David, with Major Martin and Sergeant Thunder, but only Major Martin came inside the stable to examine me. The others leaned over the stable door and watched. He approached me cautiously, crouching down by my foreleg to examine my wound. Then he ran his hands all over me from my ears, down my back to my tail, before standing back to survey me from the other side of the stable. He was shaking his head ruefully as he turned to speak to the others.
"What do you think, Sergeant?" he asked.
"Same as you from the look of him, sir," said Sergeant Thunder. "He's standing there like a block of wood. Tail stuck out, can't hardly move his head, not much doubt about it, sir."
"None," said Major Martin.
"None whatsoever.
We've had a lot of it out here. If it isn't confounded, rusty barbed wire, then it's shrapnel wounds. One little fragment left inside, one cut, that's all it takes. I've seen it time and again."
"I'm sorry, my lad," the Major said, putting his hand on Albert's shoulder to console him. "I know how much this horse means to you, but there's precious little we can do for him, not in his condition."
"What do you mean, sir?"
Albert asked, tremor in his voice.
"How do you mean, sir? What's the matter with him, sir? Can't be a lot wrong, can there? He was right as rain yesterday, except he wasn't finishing his feed, a little stiff, perhaps, but otherwise right as rain he was."
"It's tetanus, son," said Sergeant Thunder. "Lockjaw, they calls it. It's written all over him. That wound of his must have festered afore we got him in here. And once an horse has tetanus, there's very little chance, very little indeed."
"Best to end it quickly," Major Martin said. "No point in an animal suffering. Better for him and better for you."
"No, sir," Albert protested, still incredulous. "No, you can't, sir. Not with Joey. We must try something. There must be something you can do. You can't just give up, sir. You can't. Not with Joey."
David spoke up now in support. "Begging your pardon, sir," he said, "but I remembers you telling us when we first came in here that an horse's life is perhaps even more important than a man's, because an horse hasn't got no evil in him, excepting any that's been put there by men. I remembers you saying that our job in the veterinary corps was to work night and day, 26 hours a day if we need to save and help every horse that we could. And every horse was valuable in itself and valuable to the war effort. No horse, no guns, no horse, no ammunition, no horse, no cavalry, no horse, no ambulances, no horse, no water for the troops at the front. Lifeline of the old army, you said, sir. We must never give up, you said, because where there's life, there's still hope. That's all. That's what you said, sir. Begging your pardon, sir."
"You watch your lips, son," said Sergeant Thunder sharply. "That's no way to speak to an officer. If the Major here thought there was a chance in a million of saving this poor animal, he'd have a crack at it, wouldn't you, sir? Isn't that right, sir?"
Major Martin looked hard at Sergeant Thunder, taking his meaning, and then nodded slowly.
"All right, Sergeant. You made your point. Of course there's a chance," he said carefully. "But if once we start with a case of tetanus, then it's a full-time job for one man for a month or more, and even then the horse has hardly more than one chance in 1,000, if that."
"Please, sir," Albert pleaded. "Please, sir, I'll do it all, sir, and I'll fit in my other horses too, sir. Honest I would, sir."
"And I'll help him, sir," David said. "All the lads will, I know they will. You see, sir, that Joey's a bit special for everyone here, what with him being Bertie's own horse back home and all."
"That's the spirit, son," said Sergeant Thunder. "And it's true, sir. There is something a bit special about this one, you know, after all he's been through. With your permission, sir, I think we ought to give him that chance."
"You have my personal guarantee, sir, that no other horse will be neglected. Stables will be run shipshape and Bristol fashion like always."
Major Martin put his hands on the stable door.
"Right, Sergeant," he said. "You're on.
I like a challenge as well as the next man. I want a sling rigged up in here. This horse must not be allowed to get off his legs. Once he's down, he'll never get up again. I want a note added to standing orders, Sergeant, that no one's to talk in anything but a whisper in this yard. He won't like any noise, not with tetanus. I want a bed of short, clean straw and fresh every day. I want the windows covered over so that he's kept always in the dark. He's not to be fed any hay. Could choke on it. Just milk and oatmeal gruel. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, if it does. You'll find his mouth will lock tighter as the days go by. But he must go on feeding and he must drink. If he doesn't, then he'll die. I want a 24-hour watch on this horse. That means a man posted in here all day, every day. Clear? Yes, sir, said Sergeant Thunder, smiling broadly under his moustache. And if I may say so, sir, I think you've made a very wise decision. I'll see to it, sir. Now, look lively, you two layabouts. You heard what the officer said. That same day, a sling was strung up around me and my weight supported from the beams above. Major Martin opened up my wound again, cleaned and cauterized it. He returned every few hours after that to examine me. It was Albert, of course, who stayed with me most of the time, holding up the bucket to my mouth so that I could suck in the warm milk or gruel. At night, David and he slept side by side in the corner of the stable, taking turns to watch me. As I had come to expect, and as I needed, Albert talked to me all he could to comfort me until sheer fatigue drove him back into his corner to sleep. He talked much of his father and mother and about the farm. He talked of a girl he had been seeing up in the village for the few months before he left for France. She didn't know anything about horses, he said, but that was her only fault. The days passed slowly and painfully for me. The stiffness in my front legs spread to my back and intensified. My appetite was becoming more limited each day, and I could scarcely summon the energy or enthusiasm to suck in the food I knew I needed to stay alive. In the darkest days of my illness, when I felt sure each day might be my last, only Albert's constant presence kept alive in me the will to live. His devotion, his unwavering faith that I would indeed recover, gave me the heart to go on. All around me I had friends. David and all the veterinary orderlies, Sergeant Thunder and Major Martin. They were all a source of great encouragement to me. I knew how desperately they were willing me to live, although I often wondered whether they wanted it for me or for Albert, for I knew they held him in such high esteem. But on reflection, I think perhaps they cared for both of us as if we were their brothers. Then one winter's night, after long painful weeks in the sling, I felt a sudden looseness in my throat and neck, so much so that I could call out, albeit softly, for the first time. Albert was sitting in the corner of the stable as usual with his back against the wall, his knees drawn up and his elbows resting on his knees. His eyes were closed, so I nickered again softly. But it was loud enough to wake him.
Was that you, Joey? He asked, pulling himself to his feet. Was that you, you old silly? Do it again, Joey. Oh, I might have been dreaming. Do it again. So I did it, and in doing so I lifted my head for the first time in weeks and shook it. David heard it too, and was on his feet and shouting over the stable door for everyone to come. Within minutes the stable was full of excited soldiers. Sergeant Thunder pushed his way through and stood before me.
Standing orders says whisper, he said. And that were no thundering whisper I heard. What's up? What's all the other blue?
He moved, Sarge, Albert said. His head moved easily and he neighed.
Course he did, son, said Sergeant Thunder.
Course he did. He's going to make it. Like I said he would. I always told you he would, didn't I? And have any of you layabouts ever known me to be wrong? Well, have you?
Never, Sarge, said Albert, grinning from ear to ear.
He is getting better, isn't he, Sarge? I'm not just imagining it, am I?
No, son, said Sergeant Thunder. Your Joey is going to be all right by the looks of him, long as we keep him quiet and so long as we don't rush him.
I just hope that if I'm ever poorly, I have nurses around me that looks after me like you lot have this horse. One thing, though,
looking at you. I'd like them to be a whole lot prettier.
Shortly after, I found my legs again, and then the stiffness left my back forever. They took me out of the sling and walked me one spring morning out into the sunshine of the cobbled yard. It was a triumphant parade, with Albert leading me carefully walking backwards and talking to me all the while.
You've done it, Joey. You've done it. Everyone says the war is going to be over quite soon. I know we've been saying that for a long time, but I feel it in my bones this time. It'll be finished before long, and then we'll both be going home. Back to the farm. I can't wait to see the look on Father's face when I bring you back up the lane. I just can't wait.
Chapter 19. But the war did not end. Instead, it seemed to move ever closer to us, and we heard once again the ominous rumble of gunfire. My convalescence was almost over now, and although still weak from my illness, I was already being used for light work around the veterinary hospital. I worked in a team of two, hauling hay and feed from the nearest station or pulling the dung cart around the yard. I felt fresh and eager for work once more. My legs and shoulders filled out, and as the weeks passed, I found I was able to work longer hours in harness. Sergeant Thunder had detailed Albert to be with me whenever I was working, so we were scarcely ever apart. But from time to time, though, Albert, like all the veterinary orderlies, would be dispatched to the front with a veterinary wagon to bring back the latest horse casualties. And then I would pine and fret, my head over the stable door until I heard the echoing rumble of the wheels on the cobbles and saw his cheery wave as he came in under the archway and into the yard. In time, I too went back to the war, back to the front line, back to the whine and roar of the shells that I had hoped I had left behind me forever. Fully recovered now, and the pride of Major Martin and his veterinary unit, I was often used as a lead horse in the tandem team that hauled the veterinary wagon back and forth to the front. But Albert was always with me, and so I was never afraid of the guns anymore. Like Topthorn before him, he seemed to sense that I needed a continual reminder that he was with me and protecting me. His soft, gentle voice, his songs, and his whistling tunes held me steady as the shells came down. All the way there and back, he would be talking to me to reassure me. Sometimes it would be of the war.
"David says Jerry is just about finished. Short as bolt,"
he said one humming summer's day as we passed line upon line of infantry and cavalry going up to the front line. We were carrying an exhausted grey mare, a water carrier that had been rescued from the mud at the front.
"Fair knocked us for six, he did, further up the line, they say. But David says that that was their last gasp, but once those Yankees find their fighting legs and if we stand firm, then it'll all be over by Christmas."
"I hope he's right, Joey. He usually is. Got a lot of respect for what David says. Everyone has."
And sometimes he would talk of home and of his girl up in the village.
"Maisie Cobbledick, she's called, Joey. Works in a milking parlour up Anstey's farm. And she bakes bread. Oh, Joey, she bakes bread like you never tasted before. And even Mother says her pasties are the tastiest in the parish. Father says she's too good for me, but he doesn't mean it. He says it to please me. And she's got eyes. Eyes as blue as cornflowers. Hair as gold as ripe corn. And skin smells like honeysuckle. Except when she first comes out of the dairy. I keeps well away from her then. I've told her all about you, Joey. And she was the only one, mind, that said I was right to come over here and find you. She didn't want me to go, don't think that. Cried her out of the station when I left, so she must love me a little, mustn't she? Come on, you silly, say something. That's the only thing I've got against you, Joey. You're the best listener I've ever known, but I never know what the devil you're thinking. You just blink your eyes and waggle those ears of yours from east to west and south to north. I wish you could talk, Joey, I really do.
Then one evening there was terrible news from the front. News that Albert's friend David had been killed, along with the two horses that were hauling the veterinary wagon that day.
"Stray shell," Albert told me as he brought in the straw for my stable. "That's what they said it was. One stray shell out of nowhere, and he's gone. I shall miss him, Joey. We shall both miss him, won't we?"
and then he sat in the straw in the corner of the stable. Do you know what he was, Joey, before the war? He had a fruit cart in London outside Covent Garden. Thought the world of you, Joey. Told me so often enough. And he looked after me, Joey. Like a brother he was to me. 20 years old. Did his whole life ahead of him. All wasted now because of one stray shell. He always told me, Joey, he'd say, at least if I goes, there'll be no one that'll miss me, only me cart, and can't take that cart with me, more's the pity. He was proud of that cart. Show me a photo of himself once stood by it. All painted it was, and piled high with fruit. And him standing there with a smile, like a banana, spread all across his face. He looked up at me and brushed the tears from his cheeks. He spoke now through gritted teeth. Just you and me left now, Joey. And I tell you, we're going to get home, both of us. I'm going to ring that tenor bell again in the church. I'm going to eat my Maisie's bread and pasties. And I'm going to ride you down by the river again. David always said he was somehow sure that I'd get home. And he was right. I'm going to make him right. When the end of the war did come, it came swiftly, almost unexpectedly, it seemed to the men around me. There was little joy, little celebration of victory, only a sense of profound relief that at last it was finished and done with. Albert left the happy cluster of men gathered together in the yard that cold November morning and strolled over to talk to me. 5 minutes' time and it'll be finished, Joey. All over. Jerry's had about enough of it, and so have we. No one really wants to go on any more. At 11 o'clock the guns will stop, and then that will be that. I only wish that David could have been here to see it. Since David's death, Albert had not been himself. I had not once seen him smile or joke, and he often fell into prolonged brooding silences when he was with me. There was no more singing, no more whistling. I tried all I could to comfort him, resting my head on his shoulder and nickering gently to him, but he seemed quite inconsolable. Even the news that the war was finally ending brought no light back to his eyes. The bell in the clock tower over the gateway rang out 11 times, and the men shook each other solemnly by the hand, or clapped each other on the back, before returning to the stables. The fruits of victory were to prove bitter indeed for me, but to begin with the end of the war changed little. The veterinary hospital operated as it always had done, and the flow of sick and injured horses seemed rather to increase than to diminish. From the yard gate we saw the unending columns of fighting men marching jauntily back to the railway stations, and we looked on as the tanks and guns and wagons rolled by on their way home. But we were left where we were. Like the other men, Albert was becoming impatient. Like them, he wanted only to get back home as quickly as possible. Morning parade took place as usual every morning in the centre of the cobbled yard, followed by Major Martin's inspection of the horses and stables. But one dreary, drizzling morning, with the wet cobbles shining grey in the early morning light, Major Martin did not inspect the stables as usual. Sergeant Thunder stood the men at ease, and Major Martin announced the re-embarkation plans for the unit. He was finishing his short speech. So, we shall be at Victoria Station by 6 o'clock on Saturday evening, with any luck. Chances are you'll all be home for Christmas. Permission to speak, sir, Sergeant Thunder ventured. Carry on, Sergeant. It's about the horses, sir, Sergeant Thunder said. I think the men would like to know what's going to happen with the horses. Will they be with us on the same ship, sir, or will they be coming along later? Major Martin shifted his feet and looked down at his boots. He spoke softly as if he did not want to be heard. No, Sergeant, he said. I'm afraid the horses won't be coming with us at all. There was an audible muttering of protest from the parading soldiers. You mean, sir, said the sergeant, you mean that they'll be coming on a later ship? No, Sergeant, said the major, slapping his side with his swagger stick. I don't mean that.
I mean exactly what I said. I mean they will not be coming with us at all. These horses will be staying in France.
Here, sir, said the sergeant.
But how can they, sir? We'll be looking after them. We've got cases here that need attention all day and every day.
The major nodded, his eyes still looking at the ground.
You'll not like what I have to tell you, he said. I'm afraid a decision has been taken to sell off many of the army's horses here in France. All the horses we have here are either sick or have been sick. It's not considered worthwhile to transport them back home. My orders are to hold a horse sale here in this courtyard tomorrow morning. A notice has been posted in neighbouring towns to that effect. They are to be sold by auction.
Auctioned off, sir. Our horses to be put under the hammer after all they've been through.
The sergeant spoke politely, but only just.
But you know what that means, sir. You know what will happen.
Yes, sergeant, said Major Martin. I know what will happen to them. But there's nothing anyone can do. We're in the army, sergeant, and I don't have to remind you that orders are orders.
But you know what they'll go for, said Sergeant Thunder, barely disguising the disgust in his voice. There's thousands of our horses out here in France, sir. War veterans they are. Do you mean to say that after all they've been through, after all we've done looking after them, after all you've done, sir, that they're to end up like that? I can't believe they mean it, sir.
Well, I'm afraid they do, said the major stiffly. Some of them may end up as you suggest. I can't deny it, sergeant. You have every right to be indignant, every right. I'm not too happy about it myself, as you can imagine. But by tomorrow, most of these horses will have been sold off, and we shall be moving out ourselves the day after. And you know, sergeant, and I know, there's not a blind thing I can do about it.
Albert's voice rang out across the yard.
What, all of them, sir? Every one of them? Even Joey, that we brought back from the dead, even him?
Major Martin said nothing, but turned on his heel and walked away. Chapter 20. There was an air of determined conspiracy abroad in the yard that day. Whispering groups of men in dripping greatcoats, their collars turned up to keep the rain from their necks, huddled together, their voices low and earnest. Albert seemed scarcely to notice me all day. He would neither talk to me nor even look at me, but hurried through the daily routine of mucking out, haying up and grooming in a deep and gloomy silence. I knew, as every horse in the yard knew, that we were threatened. I was torn with anxiety. An ominous shadow had fallen on the yard that morning, and not one of us could settle in our stables. When we were led out for exercise, we were jumpy and skittish, and Albert, like the other soldiers, responded with impatience, jerking sharply at my halter, something I'd never known him to do before. That evening the men were still talking, but now Sergeant Thunder was with them, and they all stood together in the darkening yard. I could just see in the last of the evening light the glint of money in their hands. Sergeant Thunder carried a small tin box which was being passed around from one to the other, and I heard the clink of coins as they were dropped in. The rain had stopped now, and it was a still evening, so I could just make out Sergeant Thunder's low, growling voice.
That's the best we can do, lads, he was saying. It's not a lot, but then we haven't got a lot, have we? No one ever gets rich in this man's army. Now, I'll do the bidding, like I said. It's against orders, but I'll do it. Mind you, I'm not promising anything.
He paused and looked over his shoulder before going on.
I'm not supposed to tell you this. The major said not to, and make no mistake, I'm not in the habit of disobeying officers' orders. But we aren't at war anymore, and anyway, this order was more like advice, so to speak. So I'm telling you this because I wouldn't like you to think badly of the major. He knows what's going on right enough. Matter of fact, the whole thing was his own idea. It was him that told me to suggest it to you in the first place. What's more, lads, he's given us every penny of his pay that he had saved up. Every penny. It's not much, but it'll help. Of course, I don't have to tell you that no one says a word about this, not a dicky bird. If this was to get about, then he goes for the high jump like all of us would. So, mum's the word, clear?
Have you got enough, Sarge?
I could hear that it was Albert's voice speaking.
I'm hoping so, son,
Sergeant Thunder said, shaking the tin.
I'm hoping so. Now, let's all of us get some shut-eye. I want you layabouts up bright and early in the morning, and then Morse is looking their thundering best. It's the last thing we'll be doing for them. Least we can do for them, it seems to me.
And so the group dispersed, the men walking away in twos and threes, shoulders hunched against the cold, their hands deep in their greatcoat pockets. One man only was left standing by himself in the yard. He stood for a moment looking up at the sky before walking over towards my stable. I could tell it was Albert from the way he walked. It was that rolling farmer's gait with the knees never quite straightening up after each stride. He pushed back his peaked cap as he leant over the stable door.
I've done all I can, Joey, he said. We all have. I can't tell you any more, because I know you'd understand every word I said, and then you'd only worry yourself sick with it. This time, Joey, I can't even make you a promise like I did when Father sold you off to the army. I can't make you a promise because I don't know whether I can keep it. I asked old Thunder to help, and he helped. I asked the Major to help, and he helped. And now I've just asked God, because when all's said and done, it's all up to him. We've done all we can, that's for certain sure. I remember old Miss Wirtle telling me in Sunday school back home once, God helps those that helps themselves. Mean old devil she was, but she knew her scriptures right enough. God bless you, Joey. Sleep tight.
And he put out his clenched fist and rubbed my muzzle, and then stroked each of my ears in turn before leaving me alone in the dark of the stables. It was the first time he had talked to me like that since the day David had been reported killed, and it warmed my heart just to listen to him. The day dawned bright over the clock tower, throwing the long, lean shadows of the poplars beyond across the cobbles that glistened with frost. Albert was up with the others before Revalli was blown, so that by the time the first buyers arrived in the yard in their carts and cars, I was fed and watered and groomed so hard that my winter coat gleamed red as I was led out into the morning sun. The buyers were gathered in the middle of the yard, and we were led, all those that could walk, around the perimeter of the yard in a grand parade before being brought out one by one to face the auctioneer and the buyers. I found myself waiting in my stable, watching every horse in the yard being sold ahead of me. I was, it seemed, to be the last to be brought out. Distant echoes of an earlier auction sent me suddenly into a feverish sweat, but I forced myself to remember Albert's reassuring words of the night before, and in time my heart stopped racing. So, when Albert led me out into the yard, I was calm and easy in my stride. I had unswerving faith in him as he patted my neck gently and whispered secretly in my ear. There were audible and visible signs of approval from the buyers as he walked me round in a tight circle, bringing me at last to a standstill, facing a line of red, craggy faces and grasping, greedy eyes. Then I noticed in amongst the shabby coats and hats of the buyers the still, tall figure of Sergeant Thunder towering above them, and to one side the entire veterinary unit lined up along the wall and watching the proceedings anxiously. The bidding began. I was clearly much in demand, for the bidding was swift to start with, but as the price rose I could see more heads shaking, and very soon there seemed to be only two bidders left. One was old Thunder himself, who would touch the corner of his cap with his stick almost like a salute to make his bid, and the other was a thin, wiry little man with weasel eyes who wore on his face a smile so full of consummate greed and evil that I could hardly bear to look at him. Still the price moved up.
At 25, 26, at 27, 27 I'm bid, on my right, 27 I'm bid. Any more, please? It's against the sergeant there at 27. Any more, please? He's a fine young animal, as you can see. Got to be worth a lot more than this. Any more, please?
But the sergeant was shaking his head now. His eyes looked down and acknowledged defeat.
Oh, God, no.
I heard Albert whisper beside me.
Dear God, not him. He's one of them, Joey. He's been buying all morning. Oh, Thunder says he's the butcher from Combray. Please, God, no.
Well then, if there are to be no more bids, I'm selling to Monsieur Sirac of Combray at 27 English pounds. Is that all? Selling then for 27, going, going.
28,
came a voice from amongst the buyers, and I saw a white-haired old man leaning heavily on his stick shuffle slowly forward through the buyers until he stood in front of them.
I am bidding you 28 of your English pounds,
said the old man, speaking in hesitant English.
And I'll bid for so long and so high as I need to. I advise you, sir,
he said, turning to the butcher from Combray.
I advise you not to try to bid me out. For this horse I will pay 100 English pounds if I must do. No one will have this horse except me. This is my Emily's horse. It is hers by right.
Before he spoke her name, I had not been quite sure that my eyes and ears were not deceiving me, for the old man had aged many years since I had last set eyes on him, and his voice was thinner and weaker than I remembered. But now I was sure. This was, indeed, Emily's grandfather standing before me, his mouth set with grim determination, his eyes glaring around him, challenging anyone to try to outbid him. No one said a word. The butcher from Combray shook his head and turned away. Even the auctioneer had been stunned into silence, and there was some delay before he brought his hammer down on the table, and I was sold. Chapter 21. There was a look of resigned dejection on Sergeant Thunder's face as he and Major Martin spoke together with Emily's grandfather after the sale. The yard was empty now of horses, and the buyers were all driving away. Albert and his friends stood around me commiserating with each other, all of them trying to comfort Albert.
No need to worry, Albert, one of them was saying. After all, could have been worse, couldn't it? I mean, a lot more than half our horses have gone to the butcher's, and that's for definite. At least we know Joey's safe enough with that old farmer man.
How do you know that? Albert asked.
How do you know he's a farmer? I heard him telling old Thunder, didn't I? Heard him saying he's got a farm down in the valley, told old Thunder that Joey would never have to work again so long as he lived. Kept rabbiting on about a girl called Emily or something. Couldn't understand half of what he was saying.
I don't know what to make of him, said Albert. Sounds mad as a hat the way he goes on.
Emily's horse by right, whoever she may be, isn't that what the old man said?
What the devil did he mean by that? If Joey belongs to anyone by right, then he belongs to the army, and if he doesn't belong to the army, he belongs to me.
Better ask him yourself, Albert, said someone else. Here's your chance. He's coming over this way with the Major and old Thunder.
Albert stood with his arm under my chin, his hand reaching up to scratch me behind my ear just where he knew I liked it best. As the Major came closer, though, he took his hand away, came to attention, and saluted smartly.
Begging your pardon, sir, he said. I'd like to thank you for what you did, sir. I know what you did, sir, and I'm grateful. Not your fault we didn't quite make it, but thanks all the same, sir.
I don't know what he's talking about, said Major Martin. Do you, Sergeant?
Can't imagine, sir, said Sergeant Thunder. They get like that, you know, these farming lads. It's 'cause they're brung up on cider instead of milk. It's true, sir. Goes to their head, sir. Must do, mustn't it?
Begging your pardon, sir,
Albert went on, puzzled by their levity.
I'd like to ask the Frenchman, sir, since he's gone and bought my Joey, I'd like to ask him about what he said, sir, about this Emily, or whatever she was called.
It's a long story, said Major Martin, and he turned to the old man. Perhaps you would like to tell him yourself, monsieur. This is the young man we were speaking of, monsieur, the one who grew up with the horse and who came all the way to France just to look for him. Emily's grandfather stood looking sternly up at my Albert from under his bushy white eyebrows, and then his face cracked suddenly, and he held out his hand and smiled. Although surprised, Albert reached and shook his hand.
So, young man, we have much in common, you and I. I am French, and you are Tommy, true. I am old and you are young, but we share a love for this horse, do we not? And I am told by the officer here that home in England you are a farmer like I am. It is the best thing to be, and I say that with the wisdom of years behind me. What do you keep on your farm?
Sheep, sir, mostly. A few beef cattle and some pigs, said Albert. Plough a few fields of barley as well.
So, it was you that trained the horse to be a farm horse, said the old man. You did well, my son.
Very well. I can see the question in your eyes before you ask it, so I will tell you how I know. You see, your horse and I, we are old friends. He came to live with us, oh, it was a long time ago now, not long after the war began. He was captured by the Germans, and they used him for pulling their ambulance cart from the hospital to the front line and back again. There was with him another wonderful horse, a great shining black horse, and the two of them came to live in our farm that was near the German field hospital. My little granddaughter, Emily, cared for them and came to love them like her own family. I was all the family she had left. The war had taken the rest. The horses lived with us for maybe a year, maybe less, maybe more, it does not matter. The Germans were kind and gave us the horses when they left, and so they became ours, Emily's and mine. Then, one day, they came back. Different Germans, not kind like the others. They needed horses for their guns, and so they took our horses away with them when they left. There was nothing I could do. After that, my Emily lost the will to live. She was a sick child anyway, but now with her family dead and her new family taken from her, she no longer had anything to live for. She just faded away and died last year. She was only 15 years old. But before she died, she made me promise her that I would find the horses somehow and look after them. I've been to many horse sales, but I've never found the other one, the black one. But now, at last, I have found one of them to take home and care for as I promised my Emily. He leant more heavily on his stick now with both hands. He spoke slowly, choosing his words carefully. Tommy, he went on, you are a farmer, a British farmer, and you will understand that a farmer, whether he is British or French, even a Belgian farmer, never gives things away. He can never afford to. We have to live, do we not? Your major and your sergeant have told me how much you love this horse. They told me how every one of these men tried so hard to buy this horse. I think that is a noble thing. I think my Emily would have liked that. I think she would understand that she would want me to do what I will do now. I am an old man. What would I do with my Emily's horse? He cannot grow fat in a field all his life, and soon I will be too old to look after him anyway. And if I remember him well, and I do, he loves his work, does he not? I have, how you say, a proposition to make you. I will sell my Emily's horse to you.
Sell, said Albert. But I cannot pay you enough to buy him. You must know that we collected only £26 between us, and you paid £28. How can I afford to buy him from you?
You do not understand, my friend,
the old man said, suppressing a chuckle.
You do not understand at all. I will sell you this horse for one English penny and a solemn promise that you will always love this horse as much as my Emily did, and that you will care for him until the end of his days, and more than this, I want you to tell everyone about my Emily, and about how she looked after your Joey and the great black horse when they came to live with us. You see, my friend, I want my Emily to live on in people's hearts. I shall die soon, in a few years, no more, and then no one will remember my Emily as she was. I have no other family left alive to remember her. She will be just a name on a gravestone that no one will read. So, I want you to tell your friends at home about my Emily. Otherwise, it will be as if she had never even lived. Will you do this for me? This way she will live forever, and that is what I want. Is it a bargain between us?
Albert said nothing, for he was too moved to speak. He simply held out his hand in acceptance, but the old man ignored it, put his hands on Albert's shoulders, and kissed him on both cheeks.
Thank you,
he said.
and then he turned and shook hands with every soldier in the unit, and at last hobbled back and stood in front of me.
"Goodbye, my friend," he said,
and he touched me lightly on my nose with his lips.
"From Emily," he said,
and then he walked away. He had gone only a few paces before he stopped and turned around, wagging his knobbly stick, and with a mocking, accusing grin across his face, he said,
"Then it is true what we say, that there is only one thing at which the English are better than the French. They are meaner. You have not paid me my English penny, my friend."
Sergeant Thunder produced a penny from the tin and gave it to Albert, who ran over to Emily's grandfather.
"I shall treasure it," said the old man. "I shall treasure it always."
And so I came home from the war that Christmas time with my Albert riding me up into the village, and there to greet us was the silver band from Hatherley and the rapturous pealing of the church bells. Both of us were received like conquering heroes, but we both knew that the real heroes had not come home, that they were lying out in France alongside Captain Nichols, Topthorn, Friedrich, David, and little Emily. My Albert married his Maisie Cobbledick as he said he would, but I think she never took to me, nor I to her for that matter. Perhaps it was a feeling of mutual jealousy. I went back to my work on the land with dear old Zoe, who seemed ageless and tireless, and Albert took over the farm again and went back to ring his tenor bell. He talked to me of many things after that, of his ageing father who doted on me now almost as much as on his own grandchildren, and of the vagaries of the weather and the markets, and of course about Maisie, whose crusty bread was every bit as good as he had said. But try as I might, I never got to eat any of her pasties, and do you know, she never even offered me one. That was War Horse by Michael Morpurgo, read by Luke Treadaway. This programme was produced by ID Audio for Harper Audio. Text copyright Michael Morpurgo, 1982. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Michael Morpurgo asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.